Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. In today's episode, I'm going to turn the host mic over to David Carroll, an associate professor of media design in the MFA Design and Technology graduate program at the School of Art, Media, and Technology at Parsons School of Design at the New School. David and I have taught together for several years in a course called Tech, Media, and Democracy that brings together graduate students from a variety of disciplines from New York City universities. In this podcast, David is in discussion with Ravi Naik, a distinguished lawyer and data rights advocate who once served as David's solicitor during his high-profile effort to recover his personal data from the now-defunct firm Cambridge Analytica. Ravi has since helped found the AWO agency and continues to champion data rights issues in litigation. In their discussion, David and Ravi explore how data protection has evolved since the Cambridge Analytica scandal and examine its ongoing impact, particularly in the age of artificial intelligence. Over to David.
I'm so glad to have Ravi here today. Just in a quick summary, what is the kind of legacy now, if we could call it that, of our case against the Cambridge Analytica companies in the UK?
Hi, David. Thank you. Firstly, it's such a pleasure to be with you, as ever, and such a pleasure to be speaking to you about such interesting topics, and topics that we did a lot of work together on during the Cambridge Analytica-related cases, but also that I had the chance to learn from you while we were going through the cases and learn from you about how a lot of these models work. So really, thank you for all the knowledge you've given me, and I'm really glad to be able to discuss some of that information and how it's now playing out through the court cases that we're doing at the moment. So looking back at where we are from the Cambridge Analytica cases and what it, the kind of ramifications and the longer tail of those cases, I think you can distill it into three main issues. I think one is, you've got to keep in mind, when we brought your case, this was before the kind of gold standard of data protection as known as the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR. The Cambridge Analytica case for you was before the GDPR had come into force. So really, we were at the cutting edge of the way the legal field was developing, both in terms of the law itself and the precedents that had been set. So it was really a test case for the way these laws get enforced and implemented. But so the second implication was just public understanding, not just that how people's data gets used, although that was a big part of it. And obviously the wider story was about the misuse of personal information, but really the idea that people had rights and had rights that they could stand behind, that you as an individual could assert your rights and use the power of fundamental human rights to assert claims against companies. I say the third legacy is it really changed the way companies think about using data. You know, the way we still now think about the Cambridge Analytica effect, the idea that they might get sued, the way political parties use data, the way political parties engage with third parties to do their consultancy, and the way the entire dynamic around personal data has changed as a result of the way you brought that case, the way you stood by your rights, I think is really consequential and something that I see throughout my day-to-day practice. As I always say to you, David, really kudos to you for bringing that case and really trying to test the very simple right to ask for access to your information.
That's what caught my eye with this new case versus OpenAI, is that it seems at its most basic glance to be a case about the request of data and the full disclosure of it, and indeed the bounds of disclosure, to me was a key contested area that our case help to shine a light on. That is, not only you have a right to request the data, but you have a right to dispute over the contents of it, the completeness, the accuracy of it. And so indeed, when we asked for data under the UK Data Protection Act, way back even before President Trump was inaugurated, we did receive some data, but then we contested its fulsomeness. And yes, that was granted, that dispute, the standing and the ability to do that was granted regardless of my citizenship and residency. So that was an exciting element, and indeed to have the UK Data Protection Office agree that the results were not adequate. And this is so fundamental to not only getting data, but making it a meaningful act, that it is the organizations that possess data have a duty to not just provide it, but to provide the adequate context around it. And for algorithmic decision making and large language model, these new developments that didn't really exist as such when we were doing Cambridge Analytica pose similar quandaries to the question of access and the meaningful dimension of that access. That is it even a meaningful exertion of rights? That is, can you get the information that then is truly an expression of the right? How does the data, when you literally look at it, analyze it, is it meaningful yet? And then indeed, the idea that in the case of the Cambridge Analytica story, we successfully could have established that we had a right to know, but because of the specifics of the liquidation and insolvency and bankruptcy, we were stymied in getting it, and the regulator was obstructed by that. But that was quite particular to the Cambridge Analytica companies, which were relatively small and could be easily unwound. We now have a case where Max Schrems's outfit is pursuing OpenAI under a similar pretense that specific users have requested data and have not been satisfied with the results. So now let's get into the new case a little bit. Based on your understanding of it, and I have a very superficial understanding of it, am I correct that it's using the same principles of access and challenging AI to produce more meaningful results? And OpenAI won't be able to declare insolvency if they can't comply. So how do you see this rolling out from here, and how can you further unwrap the case itself for the listeners?
Like most things that Max and his organization do, it's very interesting, and it's very much at the cutting edge of a lot of thinking around data protection and how to enforce the rights under the GDPR. Now, I also only have a relatively superficial understanding of the case because the documents that Noika put out are the complaint redacted without any underlying correspondence or engagement they've had with OpenAI. But it seems that you're right in that one of the aspects is access. So they're asking OpenAI to provide the data relating to the individual, to provide access to that individual, but also to rectify or at least correct an inaccurate date of birth that has been assigned to the individual. So there's a duality to the case. There's a duality to your case. Your case was about access, but you also tested the legality of the processing. He said it wasn't lawful to process data in the way that Cambridge Analytica were doing. Now, in the Noip case, on again, we don't know the name of the individual, but it seems like this duality is very interesting, what it means for the reality of data protection up against the reality of AI. Because effectively, what they're trying to do is to use the accuracy principle to change output data. And what OpenAI seem to say in response is, actually, we don't need to rectify, we don't need to put the correct data birth in place, we'll just block any information related to the data subject. Now, there's this very interesting quandary at the heart of that as to, is that enough? Is it okay to say we're fulfilling the right to have, whether the individual has, or the principle of accuracy, by erasure, not rectification, say, which is really interesting. I've tested this with some of my colleagues, and it's very interesting that my team had very different thoughts and approaches to all of this as well. And can you fulfill it? Is there a disproportionality element involved? If OpenAI says we just can't do that because we can't predict or engineer the output data in that way, is it actually disproportionate, therefore, to expect OpenAI to do that because it opens some sort of floodgate or would effectively make AI impossible to be deployed in Europe? Now, it might be that it should be impossible to be deployed if you can't guarantee individuals' rights. and all these kind of thorny questions are going to get more and more to the front of things, I think, as OpenAI and AI generally gets deployed and becomes a more common tool. Leaving aside whether that will actually happen, because I think there's a lot of discussion about whether AI will leak the hype about how people say it will be used. But I think that what you're going to find is increasing litigation, but not just in Europe. I think there'll be increasing litigation in the US as well, as you see with the Scarlett Johansson case and the use of her voice, or not as it might be, as well as copyright issues, as well as group actions in the US about underlying use of data. And there is this fundamental question about, is the public internet a public good, or is it something that individuals have control over? And obviously you have this contrast between the US and Europe. In the US, you have class actions about the misuse of that information to create the training set, the input data, rather than the output data. In Europe, the class actions are less common, and you have this question about, you have this strong data protection regime, but is that really going to be focused on output data or on input data? Because the data protection regime in Europe is really focused on the process. What is the processing involved? And what is the remedy for where there's an inaccuracy or unlawful processing? So I think the summary answer is we're at a really fertile ground for litigators. Our own caseload includes a series of cases related to, I think AI is maybe a bit of a misnomer in the sense, more broadly, just automated processing, automated decisions, algorithmically based decisions. And I think there must be teams of lawyers across the country, across Europe, who are dealing with automated related cases. So it's going to be an exciting time to be thinking about this space and thinking about how individuals can empower themselves during this automated digital era.
It sounds to me, from my sort of non-legal amateur mind, to be echoes of the Google Spain case and the right to be forgotten, the challenge of individual and regional rights of information as that overlays across global differences. So the idea is you can exert your right to be forgotten in one nation, and if you go to google.es, you are forgotten, but then if you go to google.com, you are remembered.
Yes.
Similar kind of echoes that we may be seeing in the synthetic media age, where machines can process data to then produce new medias, texts, images, and sounds, which are wholly synthetic. And then where are the boundaries therein? And it also seems to be potentially a more recent echo of an initial dispute with, I believe it was Italy, and the suspension of OpenAI until a certain right of access or something was provided. Can you provide some background there?
Yeah, so I think this was at the advent of the deployment of early ChatGPT, when the initial hype and when OpenAI and ChatGPT was the zeitgeist. When it was deployed in Europe, or when it was released in Europe, there was no effective privacy notice. There was no effective way for individuals to assert rights. So you now have an OpenAI privacy notice that delves into some of this stuff and does tell you about the rights you might have to access, as well as some of the rights you might have to, for example, object to certain types of processing, as well as rectification of certain data. But they have a specific part about rectification of inaccurate data. And here is where I think your comparison to Google Spain and the case there is very apt. I'll give a bit of context to that case and how that now maybe maps or does not map onto the ChatGPT OpenAI example. So the Google Spain case was a request by an individual to de-index a search result against this name. Jargon-free terms, that meant, can you please remove this result against the search of my name? And the individual said, although this does relate to me, and although it is an accurate result, it relates to criminal matters, which are now old, and I have a right to rehabilitate myself and for my reputation to move on as time moves on. And eventually this case got to the European Court of Justice, and the European Court of Justice said, yes, that is correct. You must have a right to move on. Your reputation has a right to move on. Your life has a right to move on. And as a result, Google implemented this system where they do de-index results. And they have this constantly evolving timeline, and individuals can make requests for their results to be de-indexed, as in go down to the bottom of the results page, you know, and maybe have the search results against your name. Now, there is a very clear difference here. Let's say you make a request to OpenAI to be de-indexed, to be forgotten, as it's more commonly known. OpenAI doesn't maintain an accurate or inaccurate record of the output. So let's take the date of birth example in the NOI complaint. They don't maintain that record. It's not something they can internally rectify because it's an output. The inaccurate processing happens anew each time somebody queries ChatGPT, and actually you might get a different answer each time. So can you actually ask for rectification for future hypothetical processing? Maybe quite unclear. Maybe this is an aspect of generative AI era, which the GDPR is not actually very well equipped to deal with. I think the difference is static processing, like you have with Google search results, and a more dynamic form of processing in the form of ChatGPT and the outputs. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this gets dealt with by the courts and the European data protection authorities, European courts, and I guess also the American courts, because I can imagine similar things being brought there. But this kind of static and dynamic processing and the differences of the outputs is a new era, and there are issues that the current framework doesn't properly address or have the capacity to deal with. And it does give rise to questions of, do you need new regulation?
So before we potentially imagine if we need new regulation, let's stick with imagining wholly speculatively how the technology might continue to evolve when legally coerced to become more compliant to the principles of the GDPR. And I think one of the things that we should take a thought exercise is, okay, if this is artificial intelligence, and if it is to be as vaunted as Sam Altman says it will be, then shouldn't it be smart enough to understand the European data protection regime? Shouldn't it be smart enough to be as clever as a solicitor and with all the knowledge? And shouldn't it be able to respond to data subject inquiry? Shouldn't AI be smart enough to listen to a user's data protection requests and then act upon them lawfully? So for example, if I were to go into ChatGPT and say, tell me all the data that you have processed about me, shouldn't it have to respond in a legal manner? And shouldn't it, and if I make a request to say, I don't want you to be able to say these things about I want you to keep these things about me confidential, shouldn't it have a legal obligation to abide by that? Couldn't AI adapt to the requests made by subjects, and that becomes part of its functionality? Now, to really get into this, of course, Ravi, we would need to invite an AI engineer, right, to reflect on the technical challenges that we're speculating on. But we can do that in another conversation once we've fleshed out really what we mean by, could AI in a way natively become GDPR compliant because of its intelligence, precisely because it can grasp the issues?
It's a really good question. You'd effectively be training the data set to provide an answer that suits you. Now, I would say two things arise from that. If you allow that level of engagement, what's there to stop anyone from changing any information about anyone else? At what point do you have that kind of leak through? It's a bit like Wikipedia and having controls. At some point, you might need some sort of mediator. So I imagine that OpenAI would have some difficulty allowing that to happen, because you could make it say anything you want to say. I could say that I'm 6'5" and I play for Spurs and I'm the best lawyer this ever. I can make it say anything I want. But essentially, I don't think that's what anyone wants to do ChatGPT for. Right. So I think there is a interesting dynamic at play there. Even if you could, would you want it to be able to do that? And would the company that owns the proprietary model want it to do that? But there's probably two other issues, I would say. Number one is this open question about whether it complies with the GDPR or not. This idea that this dynamic output, if it's a different output each time, let's say you did train it, you had the right to tell it what you want to say about you, but then it changed because of the publicly available information about you, particularly someone quite public. If you are trying to input it, feed information into it, but then the public information says something quite to the contrary, at what point is that dynamic chaos? And thirdly, isn't there a related issue about at what point does your right start to bite? Where do we want the law to bite? If you have GDPR, which is about processing and processing of your personal data, if there is new processing each time there's a request to provide an output on David Carroll, how are you going to square any kind of inaccuracy with each output and the dynamic nature of that output? And it does give rise to this question of, you know, the AI Act itself in Europe talks about appropriate levels of accuracy, whereas the GDPR talk about different level standards of accuracy. And how does this all square together? And what I think you probably need regulators to do, or politicians or legislators to do, is step back slightly and think, what are we trying to solve for? What's the mischief we need to address? And is it just one-to-one dynamic between an individual and a large language model like ChatGPT or any other kind of AI? Or are there just more fundamental issues? As you say, if this stuff just doesn't comply with the GDPR, how do we measure comply with GDPR? How do we empower individuals? Now, I think maybe later on in the discussion, we'll get into one of my projects where we're trying to engender, we've been instructed to engender rights for individuals over automated decisions and AI systems and algorithmic decisions related to their outputs, and how certain industries are trying to flip the dynamic on its head to say, actually, if we're going to create this stuff, how do we put people at the center of it, the people whose art we're ingesting, how do we give them rights and agency? So there's maybe a non-legal answer, which is just involvement of the people that the data relates to.
Yes. This question of not knowing whether when you ask a AI prompt for something and the result, you don't know if the result is either predictive text or trained text, meaning we understand that the large language model is essentially successfully predicting the next word in the sequence because it has a model of language that kind of exceeds the human brain's capacity to contemplate. So that, therefore, it makes sense to us, even though in most cases, the models are not making sense. They're just accurately predicting text. But occasionally, the models are revealing trained data, but it's not indicated as such. Do you think that there's any legal boundaries in terms of companies having to disclose the output categories, meaning to ensure that trained text can't be output, that only synthetic text can be output? Do you think that this is one way that litigation and decisions and et cetera could find a boundary in this technology?
As in, be able to understand what the predicted output for certain individuals might be, having them have some foreseeability.
And also, I'm inferring that there would need to be maybe some transparency to the end user that some information is synthetic and other information is non-synthetic. These words were predicted and these words are not predicted. They're sourced.
I see what you mean. As in watermarking, effectively, watermarking the output.
The source that there would be some, you would have some distinction between sourced material and synthetic material. It could even be down to on a word-by-word basis. Like a sourced word is in blue and the synthetic words are in black.
With a hyperlink underlying the blue text.
To go back, like again, here's where we definitely need to invite AI engineers to the conversation to tell us that's preposterous because X, Y, Z. But indeed, the law may ask for such solutions is what I'm suggesting.
There's a really good point. Could you require transparency of the use of AI effectively and how it's used and what the output is based on? the kind of modalities of transparency to help you understand what you're engaging with.
Something like that, yes.
So I would assume the problem with doing that is, I could see the attraction of it, but I'd assume the problem with it is a fewfold. Firstly, if you try to apply this kind of modality of transparency of output on every AI model, it might make a lot of the AI unworkable. It might lead to friction in the process, which then makes the whole thing redundant. That's maybe a commercial point, which is why when you look at the AI Act in Europe, it's focused more on certain types of AI or certain types of uses of AI. Now, I could give you maybe a better example of where there might be quite a very strong case for this, rather than just outputs about what's happened with the football scores or whatever. Let's say political use of information, so political adverts. If political adverts are being made by political parties or political campaign material being made by parties or those they've instructed, that material to me should be watermarked, both as having a source and as being authentic or inauthentic, human, non-human. I think it's a very good case for having that kind of transparency around the output. But I think having that case for every type of output might become slightly unworkable. But it's very interesting. I can see the arguments in each way.
That's fascinating. In terms of, here we are in the summer of 2024. If I can think back, it was the summer of 2016 that was the tumultuous political era that gave rise to the election of Donald Trump. And it was indeed chatter about Cambridge Analytica during that time that piqued my interest in the company. And then, of course, at the end of 2016 was when I was convinced to request the data that got this process started. And so here we are, two U.S. election cycles later. I see Nigel Farage is back. Everything old is new again somehow. And we are, again, going to have a nail-biter of an election in the U.S., but this time, instead of Cambridge Analytica in the political battlefield, we have artificial intelligence. We've already seen a case in the United States where there's been an indictment against a person operating out of Texas who created a synthetic voice of President Biden and used that in the primary in New Hampshire. So we have our kind of first indictment of AI impersonation to confuse voters and to create specific disinformation around electoral information. One of the most narrow places in the U.S. where speech can be misleading the voter about voting information is one of the few areas that the U.S. is willing to clamp down on in terms of the First Amendment. Going to be a very interesting case to look at and how immediate the abuse of AI occurred here in this election, but also quite heartening that retribution has occurred quickly enough to deter other actors from jumping onto this game. So that is an interesting development. We'll continue to be watching. Certainly this past semester in the class that I teach with Justin Hendricks at NYU, Cornell Tech, with faculty at Columbia, Brooklyn College, and my own new university called Tech, Media, and Democracy. We had many students who themselves are from around the world, very interested and concerned with the abuse of AI, particularly synthetic media in elections. And in many cases, students were interested in developing kind of database trackers to capture instances of the use of AI in elections because they anticipate to be a growing practice and problem. So indeed, the Cambridge Analytica story will continue as these abusive technologies find their ways into the electoral process and voters find themselves trying to assert their democracy and their associated rights against all odds.
The beauty of the law lies in the ability to have accountability and liability for people who breach the law. Now, we've talked a lot about these hypothetical situations when the law might apply, where you might need new law, or where the law is a bit of a grey area. But all of this becomes slightly jarred when placed against the reality of bringing cases. And the reason that your case was so rare and so heartening but so also alarming, was just the direct cost of bringing action. If you are the victim, if you are somebody who's arrested on the street, just trying to get access to that information, the cost of access to justice is prohibitive. And actually, there is this underlying assumption that the rule of law, and because we're in a pure democracy, everyone can access the courts. But there is this inherent problem. I think a lot of the liability for these big tech companies is there's quite small amount of companies, almost a monopoly. The problem is, even if they are acting unlawfully or lawfully, to test those issues, to test these novel precedent setting issues, requires a bit of a leap, because there's not much basis for the laws, new technologies, applying laws, new laws against new technologies. And that requires a level of risk appetite and a level of cost appetite, which very often doesn't get talked about when we talk about law. And I think it's really important that when you think about how these companies are going to get held to account and whether they're going to comply with the law, you think about whether regulators, individuals have the capacity and means and the resources to bring these actions.
So this brings us back to the beginning and role of Max Schrems as this kind of actor in the space who he seems to want to take on the risk of these certain of these actions. Do we need more outfits like his, like yours, AWO? Do we need more of these kinds of unique manifestations of legal agencies to contend with the risk mitigation problem that you were just describing?
Yeah, it's a really good point. So I think the way the Max Schrems OpenAI issue has manifested itself is not a court case, but it's a complaint to a regulator. So we do have, in theory, this layer of protection, which are regulatory authorities across Europe that have a statutory mandate to protect people's information. Now, what you tend to find is those agencies have limited resources, limited technical understanding, limited appetite to go for big tech companies because of how powerful those companies are, how they can bog you down with legal procedure and so on. That's why you see very few actual enforcement remedies from regulators. So while we in theory have this layer of protection, it's a difficult thing for regulators to try to enforce every breach of their protection regulation, because so much of our life is digital now. So much of our life depends on data, and companies that use for us quantities of data. So Max is definitely trying to push things forward, but he's often reliant on regulators as well as the courts where he can. So that's one interesting thing. I think thank you for also reminding me to talk about my own agency. So we set up AWO, I guess, in the wake of our work together with Cambridge Elders Care. And AWO was set up to be a home, a platform for people to be able to assert their big protection rights through legal cases and complaints to regulators and so on, but also to try to foster greater compliance, understanding, policy work to do with data protection and developing technology. And we'll give you some quite good examples of some of the work we've done, which maybe differs from the kind of more direct litigation that Maury does. So we do litigation. We're doing a case against Meta that relates to how far you have a right to object to being profiled for direct marketing purposes. Basically, the business model of Meta is to profile each individual, understand your likes, your dislikes, that's a direct marketing messaging to you. We filed an objection request to that, and they tried to resist that, and we've taken that to court. We're also suing remote gambling companies for how they use information and how that information has been shown to relate to individuals' potential to be addicted to online gambling and the effects that it's had on individuals. So we're bringing action for the basis on which those gambling profiles were created. So there's some interesting litigation work. But the other type of work we're doing that I think is of really important interest to you and the work we've done together. So I'll give you two examples that relate directly to AI. One is, we are currently working with a arts institution, and they are trying to take choral voices, so choirs, the voice of choirs, recording a choir, and taking that recording, putting it into an AI system, and then using the AI system to have a public exhibition where people can use the voices and the AI to create their own choral concerts. Sure. Fascinating.
Yeah.
But what's really fascinating about it, it's a really fantastic exhibition. But what's really fascinating is the art, the organization that are running this. It's the Serpentine Art Gallery in London. It's one of the main museums in London. They've engineered this project where they are recording choir singers, recording all of the choirs singing with two well-known artists who use AI. They're going to feed the choral singing into an AI system. And in a public exhibition, they're going to play the AI's output of the recording, as well as allowing members of the public to create their own choir songs from the AI system. Really fascinating project.
Yeah.
But what's really amazing about how the Serpentine have approached this and how the Serpentine have thought about this is they are effectively sitting in the shoes of OpenAI at the point of the foundation model. They're creating the foundation model. And they have thought to themselves, not just, this is great, let's do this thing, but how do we empower, how do we give agency to these things? How do we create an almost real-world example of how to do AI with humans in mind? And they've come to us to say, can you help us create a mechanism, the architecture, to bake in individual rights into the AI process? Now, that is such an incredible example of how the development of these products could be different, how the development of AI, of sophisticated systems, could have humans and human interests at the core. These can be human-centric systems that support innovation. Human rights can support innovation. Here's a real-world example. I'll give you a second example of someone.
Wait, I still have chills from that one. Not only because, of course, choral music tends to give you the chills, but just like the poetics of this case as well. Just the idea of the human voice as such an elemental thing that you can own. It's so unique to you and goes out into the world and then becomes in a chorus. It mixes together. It's the greater than the sum of its parts, but it is based on individuals. And then the idea that, you know, you can even get religious about it, just like that the music creation is more than human and will an AI achieve the sublime, even, you know, with human. You can see the poetics there, and but it can only be done if it remains essentially human. So it's so fascinating that this project has been incepted rather than an afterthought of compliance.
Exactly. It's not a retrospective fit. When we talked earlier about we've got these problems with the output data, not really knowing what is going to be said, the lack of predictability and so on. Actually putting humans and the effect on humans at the start of the project, it really adds to the innovation, adds to the system, and shows how these things can be done differently. And I'm really excited to be part of it. I'm really thrilled that we've been selected to be the legal advisors on this. And I think it speaks to this burgeoning interest in making sure people are part of this system, making sure rights are respected, and actually have that same net benefit and a positive to be, allow people to have their rights, their own agency, and how their information is going to be used. So I really think it really speaks to the work AWA was doing and the kind of reputation we have, but also that the way the public care about this stuff. It's not just, for want of a better term, nerds like me, computer nerds like my colleagues, but rather it's people who really care about humans and the wider impacts of society. So I'm really glad we've got to that kind of tipping point.
You were going to talk about a second one before. Yes. I talked about the chills.
The second matter that I thought is quite interesting and illustrative of the work AWA do. Maybe give one more example after this as well, just to tie it all together. So we were instructed by the Ada Lovelace Institute, who are a think tank in the UK looking at digital policy, to do a legal analysis of three hypothetical scenarios in which AI could be deployed and map where existing laws provide protection and then say where the gaps might be, where the automation comes in. And that was really illuminating because it allowed us and the Ada Lovelace Institute. So actually, there is quite a lot of protection here. And there are clear ways you can protect people where the gaps are. So we have done this mapping exercise in quite a unique way. It's available publicly on our website, on the AWA website. And it really shows very clear, concrete examples, for example, in the employment context, the financial credit worthiness context, it shows you real examples of how these things come in and how you can resolve issues. So I'm really glad we'd be able to think about that kind of meta level example. And the third level is we started working with unions, quite large national unions, to help both address how workers, labor, should think about AI, but also how they should assert rights over automation that's increasingly coming into the workplace to, you know, monitor work patterns and so on. So we're really lucky to be working with a range of audiences to think about not just data protection, but AI and the wider future that we all find ourselves in and the way society is going to develop. I feel quite lucky to have this agency that can work at the forefront developing technology. And it all really stems from, David, you instructing me all those years ago on a hunch about what Cambridge Analytica were doing.
Ravi, it's been so wonderful to reconnect about the sort of current state of affairs and the evolution of the journey of the conflict between data, its use, abuse, exploitation, and the assertion of our control over it, a kind of epic struggle of the ages. So great to hear what AWO has been up to. I didn't even realize all these interesting projects were going on, so thank you for sharing and helping to put the context of the Max Schrems work into the context for the North American audience, where, you know, because some of these big ideas aren't a given across the pond, it is important to recontextualize them, because indeed, we still are a country where basic data protection and privacy rights are not enumerated and are not enshrined and are always at stake. But at least there has been activity at the state level, and at least we have seen some pretty interesting bills circulate at the federal level. So indeed, a lot's at stake with the upcoming election, not only with democracy itself, but I would say data protection and privacy and AI rights are also at stake in November here in the United States and beyond. Ravi, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, David. It's been excellent. We could spend many hours doing this. I'm glad we got so much. Yeah, we did have. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I hope you'll speak again soon.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. Thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.